KQED.
From KQED Public Radio, this is the California Report. I'm Scott Schaefer. On today's show, we'll revisit some of our favorite stories and interviews of 2005. We'll talk with Grammy winner Keb Moe about his song House in California, also the California band that's reinventing Jewish klezmer music, and a visit to the world's second oldest tree in Sequoia National Park. It's the California Report. Arnold Schwarzenegger may recall 2005 as the year he needed a political makeover. We're hearing the governor will announce a huge infrastructure bond measure in his State of the State address next week. So from the looks of it, Schwarzenegger's new political role model might be Pat Brown, a governor best remembered for building the state's modern education, water, and transportation systems. Brown was first elected at the dawn of what many now consider to be California's golden era. Here he is campaigning just before the 1958 election.
I deeply believe we still have a great state to build. We have millions of children to school and school well. We have waters to transport and tidelands to tap. We have highways to build and highway safety to achieve. We have discrimination to dispel, genuinely underprivileged to provide for. And perhaps most important of all, hundreds of thousands of new jobs to be created for our expanding population.
Back in January, we talked with author Ethan Rarick about his biography of Pat Brown called California Rising. Rarick describes the state's 32nd governor as a man who loved politics.
He was a great retail political campaigner. He was an incredibly ebullient, outgoing, affable sort of person. He genuinely liked people, and he genuinely wanted them to like him. And in the era in which he grew up, he was born in 1905 and came of age in the 20s, politics was all still about retail. It was one vote at a time. And so the ability to go out and shake hands, make people like you, tell a joke, was what politics was all about. And he did that better than anybody.
He becomes governor and he sets about with some really bold plans. And one of them, of course, involves education. And the system we now know of as UC, Cal State, and the community college system really came to fruition under Pat Brown. And, you know, today we think of how struggling those institutions are. How big a deal was it back in the early 1960s to get a system like this up and running?
It was a huge accomplishment. The Master Plan for Higher Education laid out that system, sort of created that orderly system that you talked about, and also committed the state to creating a space in the university or in the state colleges or in the community colleges for every high school graduate in the state. And that was something that was really unprecedented in the country. And it was really the best system of public higher education in the country.
California, I guess, at least since the 30s or 40s, has always been had a love affair with cars. And during Pat Brown's administration, it also became known as sort of the land of freeways. How did that happen?
Well, at the time, freeways were seen very differently than we see them now. And the idea of freeway blight, that freeways were sort of ugly, that they just created more traffic and pollution that we now live with, wasn't really there yet. So they planned immense freeway systems all across the state. And Pat was very much in favor of that. He was a native San Franciscan, but when San Francisco folks objected to freeways running right through the city, he told them, no, we have to go with progress. We have to build those freeways.
Well, with all those people, you need water. And Pat Brown recognized that, and I think in his words, the building of the aqueduct system, bringing water from north to south, was really one of his greatest achievements. Give us a sense of the scope of that project that he undertook.
He put on the ballot a bond measure for $1.75 billion, almost as large as the state budget. Today, that'd be the equivalent of something like $75 billion. We can't imagine. And they dammed the Feather River up in Northern California, and built a 500-mile artificial river to move water to farms in the San Joaquin Valley and to cities in Southern California. For him, that was probably the crowning achievement of his time as governor. He saw it as something that was good for the state, that was an immense political accomplishment, balancing many state interests. It was probably the single thing that he was proudest of.
Pat Brown was a district attorney and attorney general. One of the issues Pat Brown grappled with early in his term was the death penalty. You write in the book that capital punishment was the open wound of Pat Brown's soul. What did you mean by that?
Well, throughout his career, he was always incredibly uncomfortable with the death penalty. even though it was the law of the state. And as district attorney, he did prosecute death penalty cases. The office prosecuted those cases. As governor, he did allow people to be executed. He didn't commute every sentence. So he struggled with this choice, a devil's choice, really, between enforcing the law, which he thought he had the obligation to do, and abiding by his conscience, which was very much opposed to the death penalty. And he always sort of came down a little bit on both sides of that issue.
And there was one case in particular you write about in 1960 where he denied clemency, then he changed his mind at the last minute, and lo and behold, his son Jerry Brown had something to do with that.
Yes, and it was not just a case, it was a world-famous case. Carol Chessman, a convicted kidnapper, had written best-selling books on death row and become a worldwide celebrity. The night before the execution, Jerry Brown called up his father and asked him to give a reprieve, to delay the execution and seek abolition of the death penalty. And Pat agreed to do that, even though he knew, really, that the legislature was never going to abolish the death penalty.
And all hell broke loose.
All hell broke loose. And then, some months later, Chessman is executed. And so in the end, Pat had angered both sides.
And he calls that year the worst year of his life.
Yes. He was very depressed after that. He writes in his diary that he was very down and very low. It was a very, very tough time.
Nonetheless, 1962, he gets reelected. He beats Richard Nixon solidly, the former vice president who narrowly lost to John Kennedy. And then he sort of slips into a series of problems, some of which were his doing, some of which weren't. He fought with Jess Unruh, the powerful Democrat in the assembly, unrest on the Berkeley campus, the Watts riots, and so on. And you write that he was, quote, a tired old governor by 1966 when he came up against Ronald Reagan. Just worn down by the office?
Worn down by the office and worn down by the turmoil of what we now think of as the 60s. Pat had been caught in a vortex of the times, a lot of turmoil, and he was worn down by people blaming him for that, for those sorts of events. And also, yeah, I think just by 8 years as governor.
So you look back at his administration, he presided over huge investments in California schools, transportation, public works like the water systems we talked about. To what extent do you think that was a reflection of Pat Brown's philosophy of government versus just the times he lived in? He happened to be there when the state was undergoing this massive growth.
It was a combination of both. It's true that the state was undergoing massive growth and that the state did need to build things to handle all that growth. But Pat did seize that moment, and he very much believed that government had a role to play in solving society's problems. He'd started off as a Republican and become a Democrat during the New Deal, and he was always really a child of the New Deal. He thought that government had a role to play, did some things well. He would never have said, as Reagan said, that government was the problem, not the solution. So he was there at the right time, but he also did seize his moment.
The book is called California Rising, The Life and Times of Pat Brown. Ethan Rarick, thanks for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
Last winter, strong winds and heavy snow knocked down some of the giant trees in Sequoia National Park. The bad weather took the top half off the Washington tree. That's the second largest tree in the world. Earlier this year, Sasha Coca took an icy hike with some park rangers to survey the damage.
To get to the Washington tree in the summer, it's an easy trip down a paved path from a parking lot. But in the winter, it's an hour-long trek along an icy trail littered with branches. Ranger Alexander Pickovit uses a ski pole to make sure she doesn't slip as she and biologist Tony Caprio make their way towards the tree. We pass dozens of majestic cinnamon-colored sequoias. They all have stocky trunks that look like elephant feet. Then we cross a stream and suddenly, there it is.
To see something that is 2,000 to 3,000 years old and to be able to watch it, its life cycle, its process, I'm in awe of what it's gone through.
Pickovit says a wildfire a few years ago destroyed this giant tree's top foliage, including an arm-like branch that made it look like the tree was waving. After this year's winter storms, it lost more than half its height. Now it looks like a wooden fang, with just a few sparse branches on one side. The tree is hollow, like a big straw. Biologist Caprio and I enter through an opening in the trunk.
Wow, it smells really ashy in here. So that fire was 2 years ago, and it still smells.
Huh. So you can see up in this hollow here, it's very carved wood, but there's light coming in from up there.
So
when I look up, I'm actually looking up at the sky through, right, what, 100 and some feet of tree? Mm-hmm. Back outside the tree, Pigavit points out pieces that have fallen down. She rips off a chunk of fibrous bark from one of them. This kind of damage is part of a natural process. Pigavit says seeing a famous tree like this break down reminds some people of their own mortality.
In our short lives of less than 100 years, or whatever the human life can be, to look at a sequoia, it kind of holds out hope that you can be, you know, around for a very long time. Something will be around for generations of your own family to see and have an experience with. And when you see that start to decline, it starts to remind you that nothing lasts forever.
The Washington could survive for hundreds more years, or it could decline more quickly. For now, scientists say the loss of the tree's foliage means there's more light for smaller saplings nearby, allowing the next generation of sequoias to grow. For the California Report, I'm Sasha Coca in Sequoia National Park.
Traditional Jewish music known as klezmer has a long history of change. The music of Eastern European Jews originated 600 years ago and evolved as the musicians traveled through medieval Europe. In recent years, klezmer has been enjoying a revival in the United States. In April, Jason Margolis reported on one California band that's putting new variations on a klezmer theme.
The expressive and emotional klezmer violin intentionally mimics a human voice, sometimes weeping, other times laughing. But then, something unusual happens.
I say that we're a klezmer Sephardic string band. Yeah. Bluegrass and Celtic influence, and it's not exactly a well-known genre.
Andy Rubin is the banjo player, singer, and founder of the Freilachmakers Klezmer String Band. He was trained as a traditional folk musician, playing American cowboy songs as well as Irish music. But then he and his musical partner stumbled upon something.
Both being observant Jews as we are, we sort of looked at each other and said, oh, we like Irish music, of course, we love this music, but why don't we play Jewish music? Why don't we try and see what these instruments do playing klezmer music?
The dominant instruments in most klezmer music are the violin and clarinet. The Freilachmakers trade the clarinet for the banjo and the mandolin. The band practices in a backyard cabana behind the house of one of the band members. Today, they're rehearsing a Ukrainian dance song. At first.
Yeah, I would say that this is a California kind of thing. I would. Are we defining a new genre? I probably would have to leave that to others.
Rubin says each band member brings a range of influences into the mix.
Our credo almost as a band is, oh, you can do that? Oh, we should take advantage of that and do it that way.
The Freilachmakers literally means the makers of Freilach, the Yiddish word for joy. And they're also extending that passion for music to new genres. This is the music of the Sephardim, the Jews who came from Spain. Brazilian-born Felipe Fejas joined the band as a guitarist and singer 5 years ago. He's now helping the band create a new style of Sephardic music. This is a recording of the popular Sephardic love song, Puncha La Rosa, as sung by Fejas.
Puncha, puncha la rosa.
Fejas says he changed the traditional arrangement away from a waltz to a jazzy bossa nova. The words are sung in Ladino, the historical language of Spanish Jews.
Many of these Sephardic songs are basically very romantic, and they make analogies of the loved one with geography. And it's it talks about the force of love as being the ocean and pulling you in.
He says this final version came together the day of the recording.
I remember just about 5 minutes before we went into the studio, I said, I love it. It sounds really good now.
The Freilachmakers named their new album after a poem by the famous 12th century rabbi and philosopher Yehuda Halevi. It's called And I in the Uttermost West.
He was writing from what to him probably was the edge of the earth, Spain, just yearning to be in the land of Israel.
Andy Rubin says the Freilachmakers are applying their own interpretation of what it means to be in the West.
You know, you get a little bit farther west than California and they start calling it east. To us, it was not a sad thing to say that here I am in the West. We love being here, and we love all the influences that have come down on us and sort of funneled into the music that we make. So here we are in the Uttermost West.
For the California Report, I'm Jason Margolis in Sacramento.
The year 2005 was a tough one for many families of military service members. At least 68 California men and women lost their lives in Iraq and Afghanistan, and their deaths were felt by former classmates, friends, neighbors, and loved ones throughout the state. We want to acknowledge other notable Californians we lost this year, including Jeff Raskin. He believed computers should serve humans, not the other way around. As employee number 31 at Apple Computer in 1979, he conceived of a machine that would be affordable and easy to use. He named it after his favorite type of Apple, the Macintosh. Brian Howard was employee number 32 at Apple.
He had a great ability to integrate things from all these different branches of science and art and music and everything that he was exposed to and bring them all together and bring kind of interesting new perspectives on things.
Raskin died at his home in Pacifica at the age of 61. While Raskin's innovations bridged the gap between science and aesthetics, Fernando Alegria used literature to bridge the gap between Latin America and the U.S. A professor at UC Berkeley and then at Stanford, Alegria introduced authors like Pablo Neruda to his Bay Area students. He also wrote his own acclaimed novels and poems. Marcia Campos was Alegria's longtime friend.
He always found his friends among people that enjoy life. First of all, you had to have a good glass of wine with Fernando and be able to laugh and be able to cry.
Alegria translated Allen Ginsberg's Howl into Spanish and brought Ginsberg and others to Chile. He died at the age of 87 at his home in Walnut Creek. Several public officials died this year, including Sacramento Congressman Bob Matsui and Edward Roybal. He was the first Latino on the Los Angeles City Council and the first Latino from California to be elected to Congress in the 20th century. Roybal died at a Pasadena hospital. He was 89. Activist Janet Pomeroy believed disabled people have the right to have fulfilling lives and have fun. She built the world's first recreational center for the disabled. Cindy Blackstone is director of recreational services at the Janet Pomeroy Center in San Francisco.
Back in 1952, when she started this, people with disabilities were pretty much kept at home or they were institutionalized. And she realized that there were beautiful people who needed to be out in the community enjoying the same things that you and I enjoy.
Pomeroy was 93 years old when she died at her home in Hillsborough. Helen Frances Shapiro came to her calling late in life. She started practicing law at age 61 and eventually became the oldest practicing female attorney in California. She spent three decades representing the needy in Marin County. Shapiro died at her home in Fairfax. She was 94. Bill King had a lifelong dedication to his passion.
Strike three called down the middle above the knees. Game over, season over.
If you've heard a radio broadcast of a Bay Area sporting event in the past 25 years, you may recognize his voice. King started his career with the San Francisco Giants in 1958 and called Oakland A's baseball games for 25 years. Ken Korak was King's number two man in the A's booth.
I don't know that anybody could bring a big moment quite into focus like Bill could, because he just had this remarkable ability to be descriptive.
Sasaki ready and pours it in. Tejada swings and lifts it high in the air to right, down toward the corner. Ichiro going back, and that ball is gone.
King died at a San Leandro hospital. He was 78. Fans will surely remember his signature call.
Holy Toledo!
Boy, was it ever exciting. It was like nothing I ever felt before. Speeding across the ocean on top of the world. It was the ultimate.
She acts on a teenage, just in between age.
Sandra Dee will forever be 16 years old in the eyes of many fans. As Gidget in the 1959 movie, she did more than smile her way into viewers' hearts. She ushered in a new national craze, surfing. Surf culture guru Drew Campion explains.
Gidget was based on a true story about a young girl who lived at Malibu during the summer of 1955, and her father wrote a book about her adventures, and in 1959 it became a movie that blew the lid off of surfing.
Dee made many other movies, including the Tammy series and the drama Imitation of Life. She passed away at age 62 in Thousand Oaks. An entirely different California counterculture evolved from the work of music producer Chet Helms. In the mid-1960s, he organized a series of jam sessions in San Francisco's Haight-Ashbury district and formed the band Big Brother and the Holding Company. He brought an unknown singer to San Francisco to perform with the group. Her name was Janis Joplin. David Getz was the band's longtime drummer. He says Helms was never motivated by profit.
Chet was capable as a businessman. He just chose a different way of approaching it, and in some way he suffered for it. He paid the price. Chet really was not a guy who knew how to exploit things. He was a guy who had a vision.
Helms died in San Francisco at age 62. A very different musical legacy belongs to Myron Florin. Accordion virtuoso began playing at age 10 and never stopped. Florin became a household name in 1950 on the Lawrence Welk Show. Florin's longtime friend and manager, Warren Bills.
Everybody liked Myron because he was the same person all the time. He didn't know that he was a celebrity. he was just a friend to everybody.
Florin continued touring and performing up until his final months. He died at age 85 at his home in Rolling Hills Estates. And that's the California Report for this year, a production of KQED Public Radio. Our director is Susie Rocho. Seal Muller is the technical producer. Our engineers are Danny Bringer, Paul Lancour, Howard Gelman, and Tom Krimkowski. The producers are Stacey Bond and Erica Kelly. Our senior producer is Ingrid Becker. Susan Kennedy is our managing editor. Executive producer is Raul Ramirez. I'm Scott Schaefer. Thanks for listening. Have a safe and happy new year. This is the California Report.
Funds for the California Report are provided by the California Healthcare Foundation, committed to improving California's healthcare delivery and financing systems, on the web at chcf.org. The James Irvine Foundation, expanding opportunity for the people of California. TIAA CREF, serving those who serve others by offering financial services for the greater good. TIAA-CREF.org. Charitable Auto Resources, a full-service vehicle donation program management firm, which helps nonprofit organizations increase their revenue. Online at charitableautoresources.com. And the Stewart Foundation, for coverage of important issues in public education.